Well, Robert Jackson is one of the great Supreme Court justices of American history. He served on the court in the 40s and on into the 50s. I think he might have started around 38 or 39, if I remember correctly. He is perhaps the finest writer ever to sit on the Supreme Court. And he was, the reason that is so relevant, his name is so relevant here, is that he was the America's first chief counsel at the Nuremberg War Crimes prosecutions. And he was the man who said in really very stirring words, almost as stirring as some of the words that Lincoln used in speeches like the Gettysburg Address and the second inaugural, that the victors were not here creating victors' justice. They were creating a law to govern victors and vanquished alike now and in the future, and pointed out other things similarly. But very very ringing phrases that he used in his opening address to the War Crimes Tribunal.
Dean Lawrence Velville, recently, since the Obama administration has come to power, there have been an acceleration of these memos being publicly released. And there's also the report that was leaked recently from the International Committee of the Red Cross. What role will those play in possible war crimes prosecutions?
They could, of course, be introduced as evidence, or at least an attempt could be made to introduce them as evidence. Although in a formal trial, this may be difficult because a report is hearsay. There are ways to get it in, even though it's hearsay, but you would at least have to overcome that initial barrier. More importantly, they are a roadmap as to what happened, who did it, when it was done, who wrote whom, who spoke to whom, who did what to whom. And being a roadmap, they will serve to identify witnesses who will be brought before the tribunal to give testimony under oath. So I think that, and of course, they're playing a vital role in, well, for lack of a better phrase, preparing the public for war crimes trials, or causing the public to believe that there ought to be war crimes trials, because the more you hear about this, the worse it gets. Just to give you an example of how some of this stuff affected me, a few months ago I read that the Americans who committed torture used to use something called a peroneal strike. Now, what that means is you keep smashing a guy in the leg just above the knee. And one fellow who I believe died from all this afterwards, the attending physician, said his leg had been pulpified. Now, think about that. They hit a guy in the leg so often and so hard in exactly the right place, which is the soft tissue just above the knee, that they pulpified his leg. Then there was another kind of torture which I had never before heard about. It's in the Red Cross report. I read about it in a book about 3 or 4 months ago, which was the first time I heard about it, and it's just astonishing. We would wrap a towel. Initially, it was a towel which we would wrap around a guy's neck, and later it became plastic leads, so that it wasn't a mere towel. It was actually kind of something designed to do this. And they would use the towel to propel the prisoner headfirst into walls, time and time again. And then later on, as I say, they got these plastic leads, which they used to propel people headfirst into walls. Now, think about that. Think about it. If somebody has something around your neck and they were using it to propel you into a wall, headfirst, so your face smashes into the wall time and time again. That's a pretty astonishing thing. I had never heard about that before. So these made a big impression on me, I suppose, particularly because by then one had gotten inured to constant hearing about it, through constant repetition, to horrendous things like waterboarding and, as I say, denying sleep, stress positions, beating people mercilessly with rifle butts, keeping them in cells that were so cold that some of them froze to death.
Finally, Dean Lawrence Velville, in your preliminary memorandum, you say that the Bush administration attempted a constitutional revolution. Can you talk about that?
Because of the long-held views of Cheney and his man Addington, who thought that, that when Congress had restored some of its own powers back in the 70s, which had been the subject of enormous inroads by the Johnson and Nixon administrations, because of those views, the Bush administration came into power determined to take back for the presidency and sometimes in the first obtain for the first time for the presidency powers which, if allowed to continue, would have resulted in a fascist dictatorship sooner or later. It might have taken 10 years, it might have taken 20 years, but essentially their position was the Congress has no right to say anything as long as the president can say he's involved in some kind of war or some kind of combat. The president makes all decisions regardless of contrary statutes of Congress and constitutional rules embodied in such cases as the famous Youngstown sheet and tube case, the famous steel seizure case. If he wants to seize people off the street, he can do so. Congress cannot stop him. If he wants to beat people, he can do so. Congress cannot stop him. If he wants to wiretap anybody in the world, including in this country, he can do so. Congress cannot stop him. If he wants to abduct and murder people, no laws can stop him. That's why I say this was an attempted constitutional revolution, which I consider a treason to the United States Constitution, frankly.